From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Air Talk. Good morning, I'm Larry Mantle. Early yesterday, 66 people living illegally in a Hollywood Boulevard building were removed by police. Authorities described a squalid scene as well as jerry-rigged electrical wiring. Hollywood has a long history of squatters in vacant buildings, but not the only community where it's a problem. We'll open up the phones right after the news to talk about your community's abandoned buildings.
KBCC podcasts are supported by SoCal Gas, offering rebates for solar water heating. It works with a customer's existing natural gas water heater to offer reliable and efficient hot water. Invite the strength of the sun into your home or business. Info at SoCalGas.com/solar.
Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Such a pleasure to have you with us. Coming up later this hour, John Kerry, the former Secretary of State, longtime U.S. Senator, 2004 Democratic nominee for the presidency. We'll talk with him about a variety of topics and, of course, much to do with foreign policy and what's going on in Syria, relations between the United States and Russia, as well as Secretary Kerry's admission that he's had ongoing conversations with Iran since he left office as Secretary of State. So much to talk about with him. But we begin with what is a very local story, and I really want to hear from you because this is one of the opportunities for us to take an important event locally and to broaden it to hear from you what's happening in your community. You might have seen early yesterday morning, 66 people were removed by LAPD officers from a building at the corner of Hollywood Boulevard and Cosmos Streets on the southeast corner. And up until last February, it had been the home of the I.O. West Comedy Club. It was the West Coast outpost of that Chicago-based comedy club. Once it closed down, the building was apparently not supposed to be occupied. The electricity was supposedly shut off. But what happened is that dozens of people ended up going into the building and living there. Police got complaints, they say, of weapon sales and drug sales that were going on at the site. And so they had that very early morning activity yesterday where they removed the people from the premises. And in interviews with the individuals, a fairly familiar and not surprising story. People that had come to Los Angeles looking to get into the arts or entertainment industry without the money to be able to afford rent. This was a place that somehow they'd heard about and been able to make their way there and to live without paying rent. Although supposedly in some cases, some of the people that were there were paying rent to somebody. We don't know to who, at least that's what they claimed. My question for you, though, is, you know, this is not separate from other parts of L.A. It's not an isolated incident. What have been your experiences with people squatting in open buildings, vacant buildings in your community? And how has it been dealt with? What were some of the concerns that were raised? Did your local community group or business group in some way respond to that? And what was the response from the city or county authorities where you are? 866-893-KPCC, 866-893-5722, or the Air Talk page, kpcc.org. If you yourself or someone who squatted in one of these open buildings, you found a place to live when you couldn't afford rent, you went in and made a home there, I'd love to hear your experiences about the risks that were involved in that, what sort of a community you were a part of, what that experience was like. 866-893-KPCC or the Air Talk page, kpcc.org. This is a chance for us to personalize with your community experience, your personal experience of something that is by no means unique. You know, for myself, growing up in Hollywood, going to Hollywood High School in the mid-1970s, I spent a lot of time on Hollywood Boulevard. After school, I'd be walking around, and I've shared this on the air before, I was talking to people, meeting people. I love that experience. But a lot of the people that I met who were around my age were runaways who had gone to Hollywood and they had found a place to be able to crash. Maybe it was a house that was abandoned. Maybe they found a basement somewhere that they were able to get in through an unscreened, you know, crawl space and get into the basement and you know, essentially set up housekeeping in a rather elaborate way. Even with all the safety issues and vulnerability that those young people faced in those kinds of environments, a lot of times living with, you know, people that were older that could potentially and did, in fact, prey on them. I'd like to hear your experiences. If you're someone who was living in a circumstance like that, again, this is not new. This is how people have survived under very trying circumstances for many years. It's exacerbated by the housing costs, of course, in Southern California. But my guess is that a lot of the people that were living at that building on Hollywood Boulevard didn't have income at all. They couldn't have even afforded the rents of 5 years ago. People who don't have any means whatsoever will often find the place where they're able to get a roof over their head, even at great, great risk. We're at 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Do we have Ben Thompson with us? Ben Thompson, Senior Lead Officer for the LAPD. Thank you, sir, for joining us. How did this location come to your attention?
Hey, thanks, sir, for having me on. It originally came to my attention in 2016. I became familiar with the subject building during the... Go ahead, sir.
No, go ahead. I'm sorry.
During the early part or the spring of 2016, when there was a ground floor parcel of the building that used to have a nightclub operation in it. It was called the Cosmo Nightclub. And that nightclub began producing a substantial amount of crime in the Hollywood area, violent crime, stabbings, shootings. There were sexual assaults that were committed inside of the nightclub. And a lot of narcotics use and sales activity were committed regularly when that nightclub was operational. I began a nuisance abatement case related to that nightclub, and that culminated in a revocation of use case that was brought to Department of City Planning and Zoning Administration. The case was ultimately successful, was decided in early 2017 that the premises that the Cosmo nightclub used to operate in could no longer be used in conjunction with alcohol sales and live entertainment features. And the nightclub essentially closed down after that. While I was investigating that dangerous nightclub use, I became aware of a recording studio space that had been developed in the basement of the building that was located beyond the southeast corner of Cosmo Street and Hollywood Boulevard. It's a historical building called the Palmer Building. It's four floors above street level. It has a fifth floor basement. So during this revocation of use case, I found that the basement had been converted from storage space to recording studio spaces. They were small rooms, essentially 100 to 150 square feet, somewhere a little bit larger than that, that were being utilized primarily at that time as recording studio spaces. When looking into it, along with some assistance from the Department of Building and Safety, who I notified of the use because it didn't appear to be permitted, we found that that area of the building had only been approved by the Department of Building and Safety for storage space. Sorry about that.
Okay.
And it was unfit or unlawful for it to be occupied by persons for any substantial length of time. Also, when looking into the use of the basement portion of the building, we found that many of the people were not just using these rooms as recording studios, but also found that a lot of the people were living in those rooms.
And was there power that was serving the areas where people that were living, or the electricity been turned off?
At the time, there was power. When I began looking into this, there was power. The comedy club and theater that you had mentioned earlier, iOS, that was still operating. And there were still some legitimate tenants in the upper floors of the building, which are commercial office space. The ground floor basement portion of the building had been all subdivided into these recording studios, which were being used as small dormitories.
Okay. And so is that where the 66 people were taken from the street level and the basement? Is that where they were?
No, not on this occasion. I kind of went pretty far back.
So let's, because I got listeners I want to bring in. So just real quickly, with the people that were taken out early yesterday, were they living on all the floors?
Yes, they were.
Okay. And electricity was off at that point?
It was. And I could give you a quick
idea
of how that came about. The police department began to become aware of a lot of criminal activity that was occurring around and inside the building. It kind of escalated the investigative process and the abatement of the unlawful use of that building, specifically the basement. That all culminated with the execution of a search warrant for the basement portion of the premises that was executed on June 7th of this year. During the execution of the search warrant, many of the persons occupying the basement portion of the premises were arrested. Many were ejected from the building, and drugs and firearms were seized from that portion of the premises. The use was eliminated thereafter. It was supposed to be the property owner secured that portion of the premises. And the reason being was that, that there was no certificate of occupancy for that portion of the premises. After these people were expelled, we had become aware shortly thereafter that office spaces in the upper floors of the building had been broken into, and that the legitimate tenants of the building, iOS, and some of the people occupying or leasing office spaces on the upper floors fled the building because of this new intrusion.
Oh, wow. Okay. I hadn't heard that before. We're talking with Senior Lead Officer for the LAPD, Ben Thompson. I'm sorry, we're short on time. Let me move to Carrie Morrison, Executive Director of the Hollywood Property Owners Alliance. How significant is this issue, not just this building, but throughout Hollywood?
This is actually kind of an unusual occurrence. In all the years I've been managing the bid, this is the first time I've seen such an incursion of so many squatters into one building.
All right. And has this, from your perspective, been going on a long time?
It's actually it's pretty much been going on just this year. And as Officer Thompson noted, it seemed to have commenced earlier in the year. I think after iOS, the comedy club was closed down, the building in its vacant state started to attract a lot of interesting activity that was very visible, from anyone who's a passerby. I walk by that building every single day to and from work. And I credit the LAPD for taking that seriously and going through the due diligence they had to go through to kind of ascertain exactly what was happening there and what steps they could take to avert any kind of a tragedy.
All right. Carrie Morrison, thank you for sharing your experience there. Let's talk with Nick in Hollywood, who joins us. Nick, I understand that you own a store in that area. What have you seen in the time that you've been in business?
Well, you know, Larry, I go back to 1992 when I leased. It's so funny because it's also the southeast corner of First and La Brea. And when I leased the store, it was going to take us about 6 weeks to go in. Well, it was occupied by 30 to 40 homeless people with shopping carts. And I would go in very, very kindly during the day because it was dangerous at night. And I would hang signs, please, in 6 weeks, we're going to be taking over the building. So, you know, get it together to leave. And it became absolutely horrific. I was verbally threatened. And then I would put locks, and my locks were broken, and new locks were put on. And not until I finally moved out 31 shopping carts and actually put them in the street that had bottles. It was so unsanitary, Larry. It had maybe 50 bottles that had, I hate to even say this, like urine and flies.
Because there's no plumbing at that point, presumably. Nick, so yeah, you were in the terrible position, the property owner, the new owner, to deal with that. Let me share some other comments. Appreciate the call. Kyle in Echo Park said, I squatted in Hollywood because I was homeless. Found a house no one was living. We'd sleep there at night. No electricity, but it was a lot better than sleeping outside, even though it was scary because the police could come at any time. Monique writes on the page, I squatted as a teenager in college for a few months in the mid-90s. My husband and I lived in the condemned half of an apartment and contributed to the rent. Hubby wired up the electricity for our side of the apartment. The building owners were essentially slumlords. We were young, so the situation was fine with us. You can share your comment on the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Let us know about your experience of either having to deal with an abandoned building where people moved in for shelter, or if you yourself were someone who at a time in your life lived under those circumstances. And of course, we'll be continuing to follow the ongoing investigation into that building right there on Hollywood Boulevard with more than 60 people who were living there illegally. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. Former Secretary of State, former U.S. Senator John Kerry is with us in a minute. Great to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Well, it was 11 years ago the last time that I spoke with John Kerry. It was well after his loss to George W. Bush in the 2004 presidential election, but with significant work to follow, chairing the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, then being chosen by President Obama to succeed Hillary Clinton as Secretary of State. During his 4 years as Secretary, Mr. Kerry was in the center of a dramatic confrontation with Syria, efforts to make a peace deal in the Middle East, and concerns about the rising influence of Iran. The nuclear deal with Iran was a signature act of Secretary Kerry's tenure, and he's with us today to talk about his new memoir, Every Day is Extra. Secretary Kerry, pleasure to have you with us again on Air Talk.
Thank you, Larry. Great to be with you.
Last time we spoke, you were actually with us in studio, and your wife, Teresa, was with you. And I know a few years ago she had a very serious health event with a seizure, and I was just wondering, how is she doing these days?
She's doing great, thank you. She's really doing well, and she's tough, strong, and we're delighted with sort of where she's headed here.
All right, very good. That's nice.
I mean, she's doing great. Thanks.
That's great.
Thank you for asking.
Well, let's start first of all with what you've been doing recently. You've spoken recently about that you've had meetings with the Iranian foreign minister about the aftermath of the nuclear deal and the end of that. You've been heavily criticized by President Trump, who tweeted the United States does not need John Kerry's possibly illegal shadow diplomacy on the very badly negotiated Iran deal. He was the one that created this mess in the first place. And then Ari Fleischer, former White House press secretary on Fox News, saying John Kerry is out giving advice to Iran about how to maneuver around what Donald Trump is doing. It's insidious. I don't know if it's legal or illegal. I don't care about that side of it. It's wrong. Your response to this criticism?
Well, it's just unfounded, as is a lot of the statements that come out of this administration or its supporters. I have been engaged in the normal discussions that an ex-secretary of state or anybody in public life, former United States senator for 28-plus years, has with leaders and friends in the world that we have. And I wasn't negotiating. I never engaged in any negotiation. But I think it's wise for people to be talking to other people about what a country's intentions are, where they're going to go, what they're going to do, why they're involved in a place like Yemen, or why they continue to support Hezbollah, how damaging it is to their relationship in the world. And I think those conversations are very, very important. And obviously, as an American citizen, if I'm not interfering, and I'm not, in the decisions. At the time when I met with them, by the way, the policy of the United States was supportive of the deal. The president had not yet pulled out. So, you know, I don't pay attention to that kind of brushback pitch, which I learned long ago is you know, the way they play the game.
I would assume, though, that when you're having conversations with people in senior positions right now in foreign governments, they're asking for your advice, your opinion. They're saying, you know, how what do you think we should do in dealing with the Trump administration? So how free are you to give them advice when they seek it?
Well, I don't give them advice. They ask what's happening. They ask what's going on in America. They ask, you know, can we trust the president of the United States? What's the next decision? What's shoe going to fall? I mean, when you have 70 years of the United States of America being extremely involved in, supportive, and leading NATO, and all of a sudden you have a president of the United States attacking NATO, they're bound to ask, hey, what's going on? And it's a perfectly normal part of the discourse. And I'm not the only person. I mean, ex-presidents, ex-secretaries of state, Republican and Democrat alike, everybody has these conversations.
Well, and you had not just your 4 years of Secretary of State, but chairing the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, very prominent position, and meeting with leaders around the world in that capacity, too. So what is your sense generally of the response of you know, foreign policy leaders in different countries to the Trump administration?
Well, people are deeply concerned, obviously. It's very erratic. They don't know what to predict. They've been attacked. Our alliances have been put on the defensive. President Trump's approach has helped President Putin. It's helped China. It has not, frankly, been in the best interest of the United States of America, and it's going to cost us jobs and contracts and engagement in various countries. I think that you know, I might point out also that this administration needs to be careful about its criticism, which they're not, because they were deeply involved. Jared Kushner and people around the president were deeply involved in interfering with the prior administration, the Obama administration, and its dealings in the Middle East before they were even sworn in. You know, you had the United States Senate have 40 Republican senators write a letter to the president of another country in the middle of negotiations, telling the leaders of that country, you shouldn't be negotiating. You can't trust, you know, that this agreement is doable or going to last or whatever. That's interference. So, I mean, look, I think that what's important is that we have a good airing in America of what the facts are in all of this, and the facts clearly this administration has a serious problem with them. Every single day, Donald Trump puts out a tweet that attacks the system. I mean, just the other day, he sent a tweet out chastising the Attorney General for not politicizing the indictment of congressmen in a way that advantaged Republicans in the campaign. I mean, how out of touch can you be with the reality of our own Constitution, the separation of powers, and the propriety? So I'm not going to get I'm really not going to let this bother me. I'm going to continue to exercise my rights as an American citizen and also continue to have my relationships with people in the world who we did great things with. For instance, the Paris Climate Agreement, preventing Iran from having a nuclear weapon and making the world safer. And, Donald Trump has actually made the world less safe in his decision to pull out of the agreement. And in addition to that, he's farmed out American foreign policy to other countries who may take steps that could drag the United States into a war rather than leaving the decisions up to the United States exclusively. That's dangerous.
How does that make you then feel about the 4 years you invested in these various
initiatives
you're describing?
Well, I'm very proud. It doesn't change my attitude. Doesn't change my attitude one bit about those years. That agreement is an agreement which the Chinese, the Russians, the Germans, the French, and the British, and the Iranians are all trying to hold on to. They believe in it. They're sticking by it. Only Donald Trump pulled out of it. Same thing with Paris. Right now, today, I'm in San Francisco. I'll be in Los Angeles tomorrow. As a matter of fact, I'm going to be doing an event, I think you know, at the Ace Hotel, the theater at the Ace Hotel, tomorrow night at 7:30 for the Los Angeles Times Ideas Exchange. And we can talk about some of these things. But I will tell you right now that here in San Francisco, people are meeting from all over the world to talk about how we're going to continue to stick by Paris. And the governors of our country, Jerry Brown among them, and governors East Coast, West Coast, Jay Inslee and the state of Washington, have all come together and said our state is going to continue to try to meet the Paris Agreement. And 38 states in America, representing 80% of the population of America, have all said we have a renewable portfolio standard. In other words, they're going to continue to try to get alternative sustainable energy deployed. So Donald Trump may have pulled out of the Paris Agreement, but I got news for you. The vast majority of the American people have not and will not, because we recognize the facts. We understand the challenge that global climate change represents.
We're talking with John Kerry. Every Day is Extra is his new memoir. Much has happened since the last one that he wrote, in which he details his 4 years as Secretary of State in the Obama administration.
Well, I never wrote a memoir. This is the first time I've actually ever written about the 04 campaigns, first time I've written personally about Vietnam publicly. It's the first time I've written about 28 years in the Senate and described the old Senate that used to work and the new Senate that doesn't and why it doesn't. I described my relationship with John McCain, how it came about, how we worked together to get accountability on POW/MIA issues in America and change the relationship with Vietnam. I think my book, unlike, Woodward's book is a great book and it summarizes everything that's happened in Washington, but what my book does is take a lifetime and show how we can make a difference, how we actually can change what's happening now. And I think it's a good roadmap for this current predicament we face in America.
And we'll get to that as we continue on Air Talk with Secretary John Kerry. You mentioned Bob Woodward's book, which formally came out on Tuesday of this week. Your thoughts about what's billed as a senior member of this administration working at cross purposes with the president. You concerned about that as having served in an administration?
Well, I think the country would have been better off and the process would be better off if whoever that person is had made the decision with all of these other people to come out publicly and to engage in helping to make a difference to rescue us from a situation where non-presidents are playing president and where you have documents being stolen from the president's desk, where you have people having to ignore the orders of a president because he is that out of touch or unhinged or outside of reality and without credibility. It's very disturbing to everybody as an American that's the situation with the president, that you have these forces in the White House that feel compelled to have to restrain him. Thank God they are restraining him. But the fundamental issue is not how do we continue to have you restrain the president. It's why is he president at all under those circumstances? That is extra constitutional, if you will. And it's why we have a crisis in our governance. And believe me, every leader around the world is reading that and seeing it and saying, oh, my God, how do we deal with this guy? What do we do? Does anything we say in a meeting mean anything? 20 minutes later, someone else may do something. It puts our entire governance at issue And it's dangerous, and it's wrong.
We're talking with John Kerry, the former Secretary of State, former U.S. Senator, and, of course, 2004 Democratic nominee for the presidency. His new book, Every Day is Extra, his memoir, as well as he just said, his prescriptives, a way for the country, in his view, to move forward during very difficult times. We'll continue our conversation with him right after this live update from Hedy Lyn Herdes. Former Secretary of State, former U.S. Senator, former presidential candidate John Kerry with us, his new memoir, Every Day is Extra. Secretary Kerry, let's talk about the negotiations you took part in as Secretary of State with your counterpart from Russia, Sergei Lavrov, with your counterpart in Iran, Javad Zarif. With these individuals who have understandably very different priorities than the administration that you're representing, when you're engaged in high-level diplomacy, how do you determine the honesty of these individuals, many of whom I presume you've known for years, but you have to rely on your ability to read them? And how far does that go?
Well, that's a really good question. It goes only so far as you are guaranteeing in your own mind that you're not putting anything at jeopardy, that you're actually advancing the interests of our country. And that requires not trust. It requires verification. It requires a set of very specific steps you lay out in order to make sure that the goal is going to be achieved and that you're not putting other things at risk. So specifically, in an Iran deal, for instance, you've got to lay out, okay, on this day you're going to do this, and here's the number of centrifuges you're going to have left, and this is what your enrichment will be, and, you know, 130 additional inspectors are going to be in there as of this day with the following rights. You just get very, very specific so that when you stand up and say, okay, we've reached an agreement, you know you're advancing your cause. And it's things you leave imprecise, as President Trump did in Singapore on the denuclearization. Now they got to have a redo meeting to try to figure out if they can agree on what denuclearization means. I mean, that should have been central to the first meeting. And so I think it's always, you have to compartmentalize a little bit also. For instance, we objected strongly and took major efforts to put sanctions on Russia for what they had done in Crimea and what they were doing in Ukraine. And we made that very clear. And we never took our foot off the accelerator in terms of those sanctions and holding Europe together to implement them. But at the same time, we had to deal with Syria. We had to deal with the Iran nuclear agreement. We had to deal with Paris. We had to deal. So you have to kind of deal with that. And there's a professionalism within diplomacy where your opposites also understand that. They know that. You can have bitter disagreements on certain things, but you advance certain things. Ronald Reagan did that with Gorbachev on nuclear weapons. President Nixon did that with Mao Zedong in China. So it's the nature of diplomacy that you've got to be able to separate your interests and say, okay, we got to advance this. Getting in Iran not to have a nuclear weapon is a critical stage in managing Yemen, Hezbollah, their constant threats with respect to Israel, Iraq. I mean, all those things, you manage them as effectively as you can by building a structure of credibility.
How candid,
of
though?
Provable credibility.
How candid? I'm curious of these conversations again. Let me give an example. So let's say you're having a conversation with Sergei Lavrov, Russia's foreign minister. You're talking about Syria. So we, as the general public, we get a particular line from Russia about its view of Syria and what it's trying to accomplish. When you're having a one-on-one conversation with Mr. Lavrov, are you getting more candor? Is he saying, look, you know, here's really the issues we're dealing with and our relationship with Iran and all this? Do you get that level of candor, or do you get the party line?
No, I met with President Putin. I met with Lavrov a great deal, and they were very explicit about what they thought were the problems in our relationship, what needed to be fixed. And we set out to try to deal with some of those things. I think they wouldn't hold back to express their point of view about things we had done, about what happened in Libya or what happened in the Arab Spring and so forth, about regime change, et cetera. They're very explicit.
So, and
you can agree to disagree.
Motivation.
In order to find a way to agree on things that really make a difference and find a way to prove you can get them done. For instance, Sergei Lavrov and I worked closely together to get 1,300 tons of chemical weapons out of Syria. That was a step forward. If we hadn't done that, when ISIS moved across the region, they would have come across chemical weapons. So we saved the world from having ISIS have access to those weapons. But did we get every chemical weapon that Assad had hidden out? No, and we knew it at the time. And we said that to the Russians. And we were explicit about the job that was undone and that still needed to be done, and we worked on trying to get it done.
How damaging was it, President Obama, setting the red line and not enforcing it on the use of chemical weapons by the Assad regime?
Well, there's a lot of mythology that's grown up around the red line situation. The president personally never said he wasn't going to bomb and would not bomb. He asked Congress for its joining in the effort to affirm that's what we ought to do. And Congress didn't and wouldn't have done that. But notwithstanding, the president never said he wouldn't do it. But yes, it was damaging that there was a perception that grew up that the president somehow had backed off, and that did cost us in the minds of many people.
Well, and did the president express to you any regrets over what he said?
No, not specifically. I think the president did feel that, you know, this mythology that had grown up around it was you know, sort of built on by other people and advanced by opponents. But I don't think, you know, he didn't, you know, we didn't spend a lot of time on it. We had a lot of fish to fry at that point in time.
We're talking with John Kerry, former U.S. Secretary of State, U.S. Senator, and 2004 Democratic nominee for the presidency. I want to go back to the election. You write rather candidly about your second thoughts over John Edwards being your choice as running mate in the election. You'd considered Dick Gephardt, the Ohio congressman, Bob Graham, the Florida
Missouri,
senator.
Missouri, pardon me, and
Bob Graham, the Florida senator for this. You relate here an anecdote of John Edwards telling you a very poignant story of holding his deceased son, and that he had told you he had never told anyone that story before when he had told you that story before. What kind of a red flag did that raise?
A sufficient red flag that I had another round of an interview with him and had a very deep and thorough discussion about a number of different concerns about which he made certain promises and averments.
And what is your greatest regret about the choice? Was it who he was as a person or politically it didn't?
Well, I don't want to be in a look. I carefully write about it in the book. I think I'm very explicit in the book in a precise way. But I think let me summarize it by saying that I was very disappointed that the promises made were not kept and that the performance on the campaign trail was not what was anticipated.
Did you ever talk with John McCain about your respective choices of running mates in your campaigns?
Indeed. John McCain and I had several conversations in the United States Senate in what is called, you know, our Capitol office. We met secretly and privately and talked at some length, and he considered whether or not it made sense to think about a joint ticket. But, John, we know we never got – it was sort of a flirtation and not a date, if you know what I'm saying. We never got to the point of digging into everything because I think John saw some hurdles in it. But he clearly was intrigued by it enough that he turned around, what, 4 years later and thought very seriously, in fact wanted to bring Joe Lieberman onto his ticket as an independent former Democrat. And they saw hurdles. There were hurdles that rose up in the pathway of that. It's in some ways a shame because I think the concept of a bipartisan approach and trying to defuse certain issues in our politics and trying to get things done for the country more effectively is paramount right now. I think it's essential. Our nation needs to make our democracy work. And we need bipartisanship again. You cannot make things happen in America without compromise. And compromise has become a dirty word in Washington. I think it shouldn't be. I think you just cannot let, there's a saying we have in legislating in Washington, don't let the perfect be the enemy of the good. And sometimes the good is all you can get, and you need to take it, and then you continue to work and improve it. But, you know, John McCain and I became good friends. We disagreed at times quite strongly on some things, but we were always incredibly respectful of each other. I went out to visit with him in Arizona in his last days in the weeks prior. I had a wonderful, wonderful personal visit with it. He said, "I love you," and I said the same. And I think for people to be able to say that and do that in our politics is pretty important.
Must have been quite an experience for you being at his memorial and seeing the representation of the former presidents and the bipartisan representation at that.
Well, they deserved it. There was a kind of overhanging bitter note to it all. However, which was you had Clinton there and you had Obama and George W. Bush, and I thought it was wonderful they were all there. But how remarkable that the sitting president of the United States couldn't be there for a war hero and for a man who valued truth as much as John McCain did. It's a terrible statement on where we are.
Wait, and was that not a result of the McCain family and the late senator not wanting the president there?
Yes. But that's its statement. That is the statement. But why? I mean, when you can't value the service of a POW, when you say that I like people who aren't captured, when someone in your White House can say, "Well, John McCain doesn't matter because he's going to die," I mean, my God, these are just horrible things to be coming out of a White House. That reflected the president's attitude. That reflected how he saw the world, and I think it's its own sad. Sad statement about the presidency today and Donald Trump personally.
Secretary John Kerry joining us on Air Talk, his memoir, Every Day is Extra. We'll continue our conversation with him and talk more about what he thinks are the ways to help the two parties to work better together. Is bipartisan almost completely a thing of the past, or could it be revived? We'll be back with more in 1 minute. Former U.S. Secretary of State, former U.S. Senator, and Democratic nominee for the presidency in 2004, John Kerry with us, his new memoir, Every Day is Extra. Secretary Kerry, we're seeing a time when the Democratic Party is moving to the left. There are very loud calls to impeach President Trump. You've got the Republican Party that has essentially lined up behind President Trump, even though there was initial tremendous resistance to doing so. There's a huge gap in between. And my question for you is there any way to bring more of a sense of bipartisanship to bring the country together politically?
Well, yes, of course there's a way to do it. I mean, why? Historically, and I describe in my book, I mean, I write about the Senate I came into in 1985 when Ronald Reagan was president. I was elected in 84 during a time, by the way, when Reagan carried Massachusetts. And we found a way to work together with people. I mean, it just happened. So why is the question? Well, because people weren't punished for doing so, because there was no orthodoxy thrust on people within the caucus that said, "Don't work with them. Don't, that's terrible." Or even worse, people threatening their colleagues with primaries if they didn't toe the line to a particular ideology. That began to happen. And so what changed was not the rules of the Senate. What changed were the people and their attitude. So, I applaud Jeff Flake, who is not going to be able to run again, but who stood up and spoke his mind. I applaud Bob Corker, who stood up and spoke his mind. He's been very honest about what's going on in Washington, about the adult daycare center. And now in the book by Woodward, you see that daycare center. I mean, you know, honesty has not been rewarded lately in our system. And we've got to get back to that. That's the core of who we are as Americans. Our democracy depends on facts. It depends on people being honest. And so it's people. People have to come to office prepared to exercise their own beliefs and courage, not things that are forced on them as a matter of orthodoxy.
What do you think about the effort to impeach the president? Does it make sense to you that the Democratic Party would ultimately support that?
I don't know if it will ultimately support that. Are there people who support it today? Yes. I think it's a mistake to run around talking about impeachment because I don't think what you have—I mean, the Stormy Daniels thing is not a cause for impeachment. It's ugly. But the question is, you know, what constitutes high crimes and misdemeanors? And right now, the Mueller investigation is taking place. I think it's a mistake for people to be out there talking about impeachment. I think it clouds the election process. It's inappropriate, and I'd be very careful about it. Let the facts speak for themselves when and if they are there. Right now, just as I thought it was a mistake for the Republican Party to impeach President Clinton over his personal private affair, which I disagreed with, which was wrong, but it didn't amount to an impeachable offense. And I think everybody knew before the process even took place what the final vote was not going to result in impeachment. Indeed, it didn't. I think it cost the Republicans. So I think it's a mistake to do that. But let's see what emerges. If we now have some evidence through the trials that have taken place and through the plea bargaining that we see with his attorney Cohen and others, that he's already been qualified as an unindicted co-conspirator, and that's serious, but not yet a full blossom of whatever all the evidence is. So we've got to wait and see where we are.
Secretary Kerry, what about your party's candidate for 2020? Do you think that there are particular aspects that candidate needs to have, or is there one person you think would particularly be best?
Well, of course, I think there are particular aspects that a candidate has to have, but I think it's wrong right now, and I'm not going to get into any discussions about 2020 because I think we all owe all of our efforts to 2018. We need to be focused on the course correction that can take place in 2 months. That's the most significant, important moment for everybody who is upset about what is happening today. In 2 months, if we go out and vote, we have an opportunity to organize around a terrific set of candidates around the country. I'm impressed by the people who are running. I think everybody should be. And we need to invest in our own democracy and do it now.
John Kerry, thank you so much for being with us. We appreciate it. And again, as you said, tomorrow night, 7:30, the historic theater at Ace Hotel, downtown Los Angeles on Broadway. He'll be speaking there. We have a link to the event on our AirTalk page, kpcc.org. Thank you, sir, for being with us.
And
we
can I say just one final thing before I see the clock ticking?
But sure.
I hope people will realize that my book is a way to respond to what you have in Bob Woodward's book. I think they complement each other. His states the problem. My book states how you solve it and what we can get back to and why people should believe that the system can, in fact, work. There are a lot of personal stories in it. It's not a policy tome. It's a personal articulation of years of public service. And I think it's personally, I think, as Hugh Hewitt said on Fox Radio yesterday, it's a good read.
All right.
It's a must read, he said.
Secretary Kerry, I appreciate it very much. Every Day is Extra is his new memoir. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. Coming up in our second hour, we're going to take a look at a controversial study out of Brown University that the university pulled off of its news site. Good morning, it's Air Talk. Larry Mantle, wonderful to have you with us. Have you recently found the app and you listen on your smartphone? Take us with you wherever you go. Appreciate it. Don't muffle me in your pocket, though. Thanks for joining us. Whatever technology brings you, Air Talk each day. Coming up a little bit later, we'll talk about the growing dominance of Google's Chrome browser. and what that means for Google's dominance in the field, not just of search, but following everybody as they move around in digital spaces. First, we begin with another major tech story. You know, 5G has been touted as the new wireless technology that's going to enable us to do so many more things than we're currently doing. And companies have been falling all over themselves to look at 5G advances and to be first into the space. But Verizon announced this week that it's starting up the first 5G deployment in the home in cities that include Los Angeles and Sacramento here in California. Now, these are trial locations with installations set to start the first of next month. Verizon on its website actually has a searchable put in your address and see if you're going to have access to the 5G wireless. The question is, what is it going to be able to do? What is the speed at which it's going to be able to do it? And how big a difference is this next generation in wireless? With us, the executive editor for CNET News and frequent guest with us on Air Talk, Roger Chang. Roger, good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
So 5G, you know, we've heard so much about it. Just briefly give us the primer. What is 5G intended to solve? What is it supposed to do?
5G is the, as the number suggests, it's the next generation of wireless technology. Right now, we all enjoy 4G LTE coverage. 5G is supposed to bring significantly higher speeds, better responsive networks, and really be able to connect all the little things around us. There's this trend called the Internet of Things, the idea of connecting everything from dog collars to washers and refrigerators. 5G is technology that's supposed to make it easier for that to happen.
Okay, and in the case of Verizon, so they're presumably using the very same cell sites that they use for their mobile phone service to service homes. Is that right?
A little bit. They are putting in new equipment. This particular deployment that they have, it's 5G-esque, I want to say, because it doesn't quite use the sort of industry standard 5G. The reason they did this was so they can basically say
we're there first. Yeah,
we got there first. So they kind of cut a few corners to get there. And keep in mind, this is a fairly limited deployment. Unlike your cellular coverage, which you can get anywhere, this is a home. It's a replacement for your home broadband service. So it basically eliminates the wires and cables, the physical wires and cables for DSL and cable, and replaces them with this wireless connection.
I went to the Verizon site, put in my address, but I didn't see anything about the speed that's touted. And obviously, first thing you're going to look at for a broadband connection is what are they offering in the way of download and upload speed. So have they said anything about this?
Yeah, so they basically promised that you'll get about 300 megabits per second to 1 gig, which is pretty fast. I mean, if 1 gig is theoretically the fastest home broadband speed you can get anywhere in the nation. And so you're getting this wirelessly.
Okay, so that's higher than people would typically get from a cable provider where they're getting broadband.
Right, a cable provider generally will get you somewhere between 15 to maybe 100. You can get up to 200 or 300, but you pay a lot more. And keep in mind, with one gigabit per second of speed, you can download a Blu-ray movie in a few minutes.
But again, one of the issues is going to be the reception, right? Because it's wirelessly transmitted as opposed to hard wire coming into your home. So you could have parts of your home where the reception could be spotty, right?
So that's a big question as to how effective the deployment is. I suspect they'll have some sort of receiver either right by the window or right outside your house picking up those wireless signals and then basically transferring it to a modem inside. And that modem will act like your normal Wi-Fi modem. And so any device in your home that picks up Wi-Fi will be able to pick up that modem.
So it's not a direct connection. It's a house. The house connects directly with the 5G, and then the wireless router distributes it inside the home. So then it would be subject to whatever the same limitations that your current wireless router, when you get to replace it.
Exactly. And it makes sense to do it this way because realistically there are no devices that can pick up a 5G signal. So they have to have specialized equipment that can pick it up outside, route it to your Wi-Fi router, and then broadcast as a Wi-Fi signal.
Roger Cheng, the executive editor for CNET News, with us. The product Verizon is rolling out on this test basis, they priced it $50 a month. Also with us is Theodore Rappaport, the founding director of NYU Wireless Research Center, focusing on the next generation of wireless technology. He's also a professor at NYU's Tandon School of Engineering. Professor Rappaport, thank you for joining us.
Hi, Larry. Good to be with you.
So how do you suspect Verizon is getting around some of the technical challenges that different companies have been trying to solve with 5G?
Well, 5G is so new, and what it offers is a wide bandwidth, much wider radio bandwidth than ever available before in the cellular industry. And they do this up at much higher frequencies, at millimeter wave frequencies. So what Verizon and the other major carriers in the U.S. are doing is they're getting their fiber optic backhaul, which goes to a lot of their base stations for existing cellular, and they'll be able to put these new 5G millimeter wave systems onto the same lamp post or pole, and then be able to use these higher frequencies to beam them directionally to the various houses, apartments, and buildings to offer fiber optic-like speeds with no cables whatsoever.
And what is the potential downside of the technology?
Well, it's new, but it's been proven. We proved it in the streets of Manhattan at the beginning of the decade, and the world has come to believe. And really the challenge is how can the chip makers, the companies that make the devices that go in all of our phones and all of the base stations, how can they make these devices rugged and more power efficient so that the battery life, when these eventually go mobile, they don't run your battery down so fast. There's a couple of generations of circuits designs that have to happen, and that's why they're starting with fixed wireless first. With fixed wireless, there'll be a hockey puck that you put by your window in the house, and you'll be able to plug it in with a wall wart into the AC, so the power drain's not so worried. The challenge for the industry is making the equipment in high scale, low cost, and power efficient for batteries and cell phones of the future.
And is true 5G, you need more transmission sources because the wave doesn't travel as far?
You know what? That's an amazing myth that the industry is still trying to figure out. Believe it or not, Larry, the fact is that as you go to higher frequencies, if you keep the antennas the same physical size, going higher in frequency gives you a better link. It actually goes farther. People don't quite understand this yet in industry, but they're going to find that out in the trials and as the first products roll out. So except for rain and foliage and hail, which does block these signals more, if you have a free line of sight and you keep the antenna sizes the same, you actually get much greater gains in coverage going up to higher frequencies than you do in today's cellular.
But
proved that, and the world's starting to come around.
It sounds, though, like the caveat is line of sight, because, of course, we're used with our 4G smartphones. You don't need line of sight to get reception.
Right. Well, you won't need line of sight in 5G either, because so much of the world is reflective and energy scatters. And we showed in the streets of Manhattan that you can get non-line of sight around corners in deep urban canyons just like you can in today's cellular. The trick will be, in the future smartphones, you'll have antennas that electrically can steer and can find that energy bouncing off of a building or of a nearby car or sign. So while the myth is it won't go non-line of sight, the fact is the physics allow the radio waves to propagate quite well. The key is having what's called adaptive antennas, electrically steerable antennas that are quickly looking, finding the energy around the environment.
Jesus in South Los Angeles called to say he works for the city of Los Angeles, said we're starting to see a lot of these small micro cell towers pop up, and I'm getting a lot of complaints, Jesus says, from people concerned about radiation. He says these companies need to do a better job of educating the public. Ted Rappaport, do you want to speak to that issue of exposure to the cell sites?
Absolutely. And we wrote a paper on this that's been published in the National Health Journals on the health effects and the issues of millimeter wave communications, because naturally the public is concerned. Here are the facts. We need to be more worried about putting sunscreen on with UVB radiation and flying above 10,000 feet where there's ionizing radiation, which is known to break the valence shell of electrons because of the energy of radiation up at the X-ray, gamma ray, and above.
But we don't spend all day on a plane driving around. And in fact, people who do work in the air do have concerns about that radiation exposure. So for someone sitting in an office building or at home, you're saying that there really isn't anything to be concerned with that exposure?
Millimeter wave radio waves are four orders of magnitude. That's one with four zeros, weaker in energy of anything known to create any abnormal electrons which lead to cancer. So I believe it's very safe. The only issues when you deal with radio frequencies like cellular and millimeter wave are the thermal issues, because when you heat something to where it burns, that's where you can get unstable atoms. We're operating at power levels and frequencies four orders of magnitude below ionizing radiation.
We're talking with Ted Rappaport. He's a professor at NYU's Tandon School of Engineering and the founding director of NYU Wireless Research Center. Also with us, executive editor of CNET News, Roger Cheng. Roger, what's your sense of what the appetite, the market for this is going to be? I would think it, particularly for Verizon customers, it's $50 a month for them, $70 for non-Verizon customers. But, maybe at that price point and that speed, it's attractive.
Absolutely. And I think they're doing everything they can to get people on, right? The early adopters here get 3 months of free service. They get a free Apple TV box or Chromecast. So they're really throwing in a lot of incentives. Partly it's because this is sort of a wider, a commercial level trial, right? They want to get the kinks out of this. The installation, I talked to them about what the installation process would be like. They're still not sure how long this is going to take, whether it's going to be more or less of a hassle than it is for your standard cable installation, which for me is always really painful.
Yeah.
They're trying to make this as attractive as possible. And I think for a lot of customers, it's a decent deal considering the speeds you're getting and the fact that you're getting this for free for 3 months. And there's no contract, so if it ends up being terrible, you can walk away.
What do you anticipate is going to be the usage of the technology? Do you think at first it's just going to be the same way people are using their wired broadband, or do you anticipate it might early on have additional applications?
I would say with the home broadband service, it's a fairly specific way of using 5G, and I think we're not going to really deviate that much with that. I think the real potential, the real opportunity is when 5G becomes more ubiquitous. It becomes more like your cellular network, the cellular network that you're used to now, right? The idea that you can go anywhere and get some form of that. That there are definitely some challenges, a lot of challenges with deploying these networks. But you've got companies like T-Mobile and Sprint promising 5G in multiple cities, right? AT&T wants to get 5G turned on in at least six cities by the end of this year. So it's turning on. I think there's definitely appetite for it, at least among CNET readers. They are definitely amped up for 5G, even if they don't necessarily know, what it is or what it can do for them. Just the idea of this new generation of wireless technology is exciting.
Roger, quick question. Newt asks on our page, could this bridge the gap for rural users who often have to deal with, slower connections via satellite?
In terms of rural access, that remains to be seen. We're actually kind of looking into this now, whether or not 5G will actually kind of bridge the broadband gap in rural parts, because you still need equipment. You still need that fiber backhaul that's required to send that bandwidth, that fast signal. And so whether or not this means that folks are going to invest in those rural areas is a little bit tougher. Now, beyond sort of the high millimeter wave spectrum we were talking about, the other carriers are investing in using 5G, using kind of the existing spectrum that has inherently wider coverage and better ability to kind of penetrate buildings. So you'll see 5G there a little bit more ubiquitously than I think even most people thought just a few years ago. But in terms of rural coverage, that's still a big question mark.
All right. I want to thank you, gentlemen, for being with us and sharing with us your feedback on Verizon's 5G announcement today on the Verizon website. It made searchable with your address to see if you are going to be served by the 5G offering. Los Angeles, one of the cities around the country that is getting this test of in-home 5G. Roger Cheng, CNET News Executive Editor, and Ted Rappaport, NYU Wireless Founding Director. Coming up, we continue in a tech vein to look at the increasing dominance of Google's Chrome browser. What does that mean for Google's continuing access to your information and your browsing habits? Why is it that Chrome has become dominant with 60% of the browsing market? We'll continue in 1 minute. Ten years ago, Google debuted its Chrome browser, and it's been a good decade for Google. In that time, Chrome has become the most popular browser. It has 60% of the user share. The question is, you know, what does that mean also for the increased popularity of Google's Gmail and its other offerings? We're going to talk with Lily Hay Newman, who's with Wired, security reporter. Thanks so much, Lily, for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So let's talk, first of all, about the Chrome popularity. What's the perception about why it's surpassed Internet Explorer and Firefox and all the other competitors?
Well, Chrome became popular actually because of security features, largely. It had some kind of novel things early on, like auto updates, frequent updates. Those are the types of things that 10 years ago you really needed to make sure your browser was secure and you weren't having problems with things like drive-by downloads where suddenly you'd get code on your computer that you didn't click anything, you didn't do anything, you didn't know how it happened. So Chrome was really good at protecting that, and it also had some other kind of features to silo code and keep things, you know, from kind of running out of hand in your browser. And off of that, it just really started to proliferate. And just, you know, with those basic things that we now take for granted in all browsers, it really took off.
Was speed also a factor for it? And it may not be now the fastest browser, maybe the newer version of Internet Explorer surpassed on sheer speed. But was that also one of the early attractions?
Definitely. And Chrome also handled tabs in a different way to, you know, partly for convenience and, you know, organization. And they've continued to work on those things, but partly for speed. And, you know, that also relates to kind of organizing what's running where and making things more efficient. So, yeah, there were a bunch of those features off the bat that were giving speed, convenience, ease of use, and then also the security benefits that really were just the complete package at the right time 10 years ago.
Lily, you've also written about Google looking at the problems inherent in increasingly complex URLs, this, you know, which directs you to the particular website you're searching for or that you're visiting. What's a potential alternative to those URL web addresses?
Yeah, well, that is the question, isn't it? You know, there's problems with URLs because they've gotten so kind of bloated and expanded. I mean, we've all tried to kind of copy a link to send it to someone, and it's just, you know, lines and lines and lines that we didn't realize were there. So the problem with that is that people can kind of get into a situation where they're not paying attention to URLs and they're not really checking what URL they're communicating with, like what page they're on. And that means that for someone trying to phish them or attack them or trick them, they can make a URL that's really similar, and then the person browsing won't realize the difference because who's looking at this stuff anymore because it's so complicated to read. So Google has this goal of trying to find a replacement, as you said, and make something that's easier to parse, easier to kind of interact with and say, okay, you know, Wired.com, not only, you know, that URL was meant to be simple, but now because they're so bloated, what else could we put there that lets someone know I'm reading Wired, I'm on the right site, I can trust this site? Google has been very reluctant to give examples until they're totally certain of what they want to propose, because they know it's going to be such a big change in how people browse the web day to day. So they don't want to make waves before they're really certain. But, you know, it's just something that will be will have more integrity and be less confusing, and something that's more direct, perhaps more like a visual cue or a symbol or something where you can have a third, you know, like an outside way to confirm the identity of the site. It's really hard to think what exactly it would
be. Yeah. Well, and you'd need an almost infinite number of those symbols, whatever they are, because it wouldn't just be, as you say, going to wired.com, but then every, you know, sub URL that's, I mean, it would be almost infinite. We're talking with Lily A. Newman, Wired security reporter. Also joining us is Joe Balestrino, consultant and independent search engine optimization expert. He's author of The Definitive Guide to Local Search. Joe, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Nice to be here.
First of all, what would you add as to why Chrome has become the dominant browser, despite some of the concerns people have about Google's dominance?
Well, you know, if you look at the history of browsers, they were initially designed by software companies. And so what Google had done was take a look at the data that they've gotten from search and how people use their search, the Google search, that they decided to build a browser around that was a little bit more user-friendly, less cumbersome. And then as it grew in popularity, because since Google was the most popular search engine and still is, people started using more of their products. So they started leaning and relying more on the Google Chrome browser because it integrated so well with all of those additional features and products that Google has been putting out.
So now you have millions of Americans who use Google Chrome, Gmail, Google Calendar, Drive for documents, you know, all this. There are concerns about Google having amassed that amount of information about all these users. Do you think that there's at some point where people start saying, wait a minute, this is just, it's not good to be relying on one provider for all of these services?
Oh, yeah, I agree. And I think Google's counting on that. I mean, there's things that you can do, to clear your history, remove Google from tracking you and making sure that they have little information as possible. But Google knows that a lot of us are lazy and we're not going to go through all the, you know, the hassle to kind of do that. But you should be concerned with one entity collecting all your information. I mean, it serves you customized search results. If you use an Android device, it's able to show you news stories based on things that you searched previously. So I would be concerned.
All right. What about comparative upstart Opera, which offers, I think it has all embedded with it, VPN for privacy considerations. How strong a competitor can Opera be?
Well, Opera has been around for a while, but it's losing traction regardless of the features that they have. I think the closest comparison is probably Safari. Just because of the use of MacBooks and the iPhone, and Firefox is close behind, but that's at a 10% share. So I think many people don't know about Opera and the value that comes with Opera. I think more people are just using what's most popular out there right now.
All right. You have questions for our guests. We're at 866-893-KPCC. That's 866-893-5722 or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. If you have questions about Google's continued dominance, the 60% market share that Chrome has, and what could follow the complicated URLs of today. Joe, do you have any thoughts about a potential successor to URLs for navigating the web?
You know, I don't know how Google would do it, because Google would have to have something to crawl. And then if you think about it, it would have to change the way we develop websites now. So it would be interesting to see what Google comes up with that doesn't totally break the internet.
All right. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page. And describe the crawl for us, what that means.
Well, when Google crawls a website, it'll find the URL, say the homepage, and it starts to crawl individual pages. And it starts taking the data that it crawls and puts it into the search engines for you to when you perform a search. And it uses an algorithm to decide what it's going to show based on your search. So with a lot of things being created by databases and content being dynamically generated, it'll be interesting to see how Google handles or views this content. And it may just be that they don't show the URLs and they have something else along the lines, maybe shortening the URL, like a kind of like a bit.ly type of thing, instead of showing users the whole complete URL. But Google's been kind of quiet on it because I'm not really sure that they've even figured out exactly how they want to propose that.
Lily Hay-Newman of Wired, what about future security aspects? You mentioned Chrome sort of hung its hat on that early on, as well as the convenience of the interoperability with the other Google offerings. But you know, what do they see as sort of the next challenge in terms of security to the browser?
Yeah, so one thing they're working on is they, you know, as I said, had originally conceived this idea that they call the sandbox for Chrome, that, you know, everything is kind of playing in its own sandbox and you can't just go into somebody else's sandbox. So that's kind of the concept. So that was mostly applied to tabs, like each tab is in its own sandbox. And so, you know, someone who compromises your browsing on one tab, they're not just seeing everything and they can't just take over everything. And now Chrome has extended that and is working on extending it kind of conceptually further and further to try to say, okay, well, even the components of a website on all on one tab, maybe each of those components could run in a separate process so that, you know, if you've heard of malvertising or malicious advertising or, you know, a flash component that is malicious or, you know, any of the types of threats we see on the web, that, you know, even one of those that's gone rogue can't compromise the rest of the data on the site or the rest of the things you're doing on the site. So they're trying to create more and more controls to address the types of threats that people see on the web.
What's made it so hard for Safari to compete? I mean, obviously it's limited to Apple devices, but you think with the huge resources Apple has available that they would be able to cross over even beyond their own devices and to make a strong statement in the space. What's been the inhibitor for them?
I would just say, you know, their total device market share, as you were alluding to, you know, they certainly have brand recognition and, you know, the resources to go beyond in theory. But, you know, just the total market share of their personal computers is just a lot lower than other types of PCs, so, or, you know, Windows specifically. So I just think that's the thing is, you know, Safari is more associated with Mac products and people might not think to download it on another device.
I was just, you know, thinking of like the heyday of iTunes, which obviously crossed over well beyond people who, you know, just had Macs or, you know, were listening on iPods and that this might have been a potential area for Apple as well. Lily Hay-Newman of Wired, thank you very much for being with us. Joe Balestrino, consultant on optimizing search engine. He's an expert in that area and author of The Definitive Guide to Local Search. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. Coming up, the controversy over a study done out of Brown University posted on the university's news site only to be withdrawn after internal criticism of the study and the principles under which the study was conducted. We'll be back with more right after a live update from Hedy Lyn Hurtis. The outer bands of Hurricane Florence are just starting to hit the southeastern U.S. coast, and of course, you'll be getting continuing coverage of the hurricane and the enormous amount of water it's expected to drop on southeastern communities over the course of the next 3 days. You'll hear the coverage right here on 89.3 KPCC. A study on gender dysphoria published in the scientific journal PLOS One has sparked controversy. It was conducted by Brown University professor Lisa Littman. It's a descriptive study that looks at what's called rapid onset gender dysphoria. It's described as a gender dysphoria experienced for the first time during puberty in the context of having friends who become gender dysphoric and transgender identified at the same time. In other words, the idea that an environmental influence of your friends going through an experience of gender dysphoria could have an effect on you. The study was based on the anonymous responses of 250 parents of teenagers and young adults who had expressed gender dysphoria, and raised questions about whether social modeling or even pressure could influence a child's gender identity. Well, after backlash to the study, Brown rescinded a news story on the research, and PLOS One, the research journal, issued a statement saying that it was looking into the criticisms. But the question is, did Brown remove the study because of inherent weaknesses in the study itself, or because it's taboo to consider the issue of environmental influencers when it comes to someone's gender identity? Joining us to talk about the issue from the Wall Street Journal editorial page writer Jillian K. Melcher, who wrote a piece about this issue at Brown University. Jillian, thank you for being with us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
So you interviewed Professor Littman. She declined to join us for the program today. But what was sort of her take on Brown removing this from their news site?
Well, she's not commenting on how Brown or how PLOS One has handled this controversy. But I think she's mostly standing by the study. She had acknowledged in it that there were some limits to the methodology here. It's a preliminary study. And I think she was actually pretty transparent about that. But this really does raise the question. This is a relatively new line of study. This only goes back about 50 or 60 years. And I think one of the really important things is that we have a scientific environment where it is okay to ask difficult or uncomfortable questions.
So
the way that this has been handled, really.
Who led the opposition to the publicizing this study? Was it within the Brown community or externally?
I think it was externally. So Brown has said that they're basically reacting to what PLOS One did. PLOS One has said that it's been made aware of concerns about the science in the study here. When I called them, they wouldn't give me a bunch of much information really at all about what those concerns were. But looking online, I think the main concerns that I saw were that, first of all, you're interviewing parents, not the children themselves. And the second, that these parents may have a bias. They may be looking at it from a point of view, too. And again, these are things that she acknowledged in her research.
So
it invalidates the line of inquiry.
It sort of seems to me there are a couple of issues here, you know, one of which is, was the study good science? Does it really further this conversation in a meaningful way? Or is it too small, and the parents' perceptions, is a self-selecting sample? Are they too limited in the sorts of analysis that the parents bring to it? But then the separate issue is, was this just that it was a taboo to bring up the issue of gender identity within a social context? And what's your sense of that?
I'll answer your first question first. So I think one of the things that, as a journalist, I found really interesting looking into this whole line of research is it's not just this study that has methodological issues. Pretty much any time you're researching the transgender population, you're dealing with a really small subject size to look at. And then also there's a lot of people who end up going through hormone therapy or who end up getting surgery. And the attrition rate for them responding and talking about their experience a year after, 2 years after, 3 years after, it's really not very many people who are speaking about it. So I think on any side you look at, there's a risk of a self-selection bias. And I think that's actually why it's so important that uncomfortable or I would say contrarian research is allowed to proceed. So that's the methodological side. I think when we're talking about, whether or not there are some topics that are off limits, I think yes. It's been fascinating in the last year to look at particularly in identity-based research. We had Rebecca Tuvel, who wrote a paper for the journal Hypatia, looking at transgender identity and transracial identity. There was a pile-on, and a ton of editors apologized. You've had feminist philosophers talking about how there's surprisingly little discussion going on in academia about transgender and cisgender women, even though there's a ton of interest. And there's this fascinating series of blog about earlier this summer where a lot of the professors said, hey, we're concerned. We're concerned about a slew of negative comments. We're concerned about drawing negative attention. And then I think you can also look at Bath Spa University in the UK. There was a researcher there named James Caspian. He specializes in therapy for transgender people. And he wanted to look at whether after people had gone through hormone therapy or through surgery, whether there was regrets. And he ended up finding out that the university didn't support this research because they felt it was too controversial. So I think there is a real concern here that certain lines of inquiry are not welcome.
We're talking with Gillian K. Melcher, who's editorial page writer for The Wall Street Journal. I say, as I shared yesterday on the program, you know, back when Air Talk started, 85, our program began. And at that point, you know, we're right in the middle of the whole gay rights movement for gay men and lesbians. And there was a lot of concern about sort of debating, well, what are the causes of someone being gay or lesbian? And because it ended up being intertwined with the whole push for equality under the law. And so it made it then difficult to look at that issue. And so the question I have is this something comparable now, where their concerns are about the acceptance of transgender, particularly young people, or just finding themselves in the world, and anything that would potentially undermine that assertion of their gender identity? Joining us is Aidan Olson Kennedy, who's transgender, licensed clinical social worker, executive director of the Los Angeles Gender Center. Thank you so much. Good to have you with us today.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So what's your sense of this? Do you think that this is a legitimate thing to attempt to study what, if any, environmental factors there are in one's gender identity?
First, I want to acknowledge that I think that having conversations, exploratory conversations, I support. I think it's a great idea, largely for a misunderstood community and population. And it's, you know, youth understanding and putting language to their gender identity younger and younger is a new phenomenon. And so it's reasonable that we don't largely understand it. I think, though, that as a provider, you know, been providing care to transgender nonconforming folks and adolescents for close to 10 years now, it's not clinically what I'm seeing. It doesn't bear out in my clients. It doesn't bear out anecdotally for other providers that I'm connected to. So I think that we need to ask questions, but I'm much more of a fan of making sure that we're asking the right questions.
All right. But you think it sounds like you do think, even though it's different than your observation, you think it is acceptable to attempt to study this?
Again, I would say that if we're going to study things, that we need to have clarity about what it is that we're asking, why we're asking it, and who we're asking. I'm not a researcher, so I think that it's important that I sort of state that out loud. I don't conduct research. I don't. My practice isn't guided and informed particularly by research. So my comments on how the research was done, I don't have a lot to share, but I do think there's value in research. But again, being ethically responsible and sensitive to the question, but also the potential outcome of that question.
So you one of the things you mentioned is why we're asking. And I think for some people, one of the issues is we have seen an increase in the number of young people who identify as transgender or gender nonconforming. So the question would be, is this exclusively because these are young people who wouldn't have felt safe in the past to explore this, to share this with other people, and it's just now there is a degree of freedom there wasn't before, and that is it in totality? Or is that part, maybe even, you know, overwhelmingly the majority, but that there is another potential that as young people are exposed to other people who are openly sharing about being transgender, that has an influence on one's perception of one's own gender? And so my question for you is, you know, is that legitimate to look at?
I think that there are multiple factors on why young people are able to better understand and essentially put language to their gender, which then leads to what we commonly sort of call as coming out, if you will. certainly the availability, the space that's been created, the movement of the trans community, and our acquisition of social and political rights has trickled down and created space for young people that didn't exist before. But I think also that while, some of the argument is like the social contagion, that if you have trans youth or people around that young person, that it's going to create a pathway of exploration and conversation that would not have otherwise been there. And I think that where truth lies in that is that it is true that when we become exposed to things, we also then create opportunities to explore self in relation to that new information. What delineates and what is very different for trans youth who have gender dysphoria is that the exploration for somebody who's not trans, usually, rarely, or I would even be willing to say next to never, leads to both internalized and externalized distress. And so there are tons of kids exploring gender expression and gender performance. I think that's amazing and wonderful, and it's going to benefit all of us. But that's a very different thing than kids who are talking about and putting words to an experience of incongruency, an experience of distress, and then also the need and the drive and the pursuit for medical intervention to help alleviate that distress.
We're talking with the executive director of the LA Gender Center, licensed clinical social worker, Aidan Olson Kennedy. We have a third guest we'll bring into the conversation from NYU Langone's Child Study Center, the clinical director of the Gender and Sexuality Service there. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. If you want to weigh in on the conversation we're having about Brown University's new service withdrawing a study that was condemned by many in the transgender community. We're at 866-893-KPCC. Back in a minute. Coming up, Fresh Air with Terry Gross here on 89.3 KPCC. Been a great week of guests with Terry, and today she continues with Michael Che and Colin Jost. They're preparing for the new Saturday Night Live season, get a little bit of a preview perhaps, and also ready to host the Emmys coming up Monday night. That's Fresh Air with Terry Gross here on 89.3 KPCC. We continue our conversation about a controversial Brown University-based study looking at transgender environmental factors, particularly among young people and their self-identification by gender. Joining us is Aaron Jansen, the clinical director of the Gender and Sexuality Service at NYU's Child Studies Center. Thank you so much for joining us, Dr. Jansen.
Thank you for having me.
So what are your thoughts about attempting to study the factors involved in gender identity and this particular Brown study?
I have no problem with considering and understanding how folks come to understand their own identity, particularly when it comes to folks who have gender dysphoria, where there is that intense amount of distress between the incongruence between identity and body. However, these studies should be thoughtful, they should be well-designed, and they should be ethical. And unfortunately, this study is none of those three things and is really quite problematic. And I can take it apart from A to Z, but I would say the place I would want to start is this idea of the term rapid onset gender dysphoria. It's something that's really taken hold in kind of popular press since this was published, but the reality is that rapid onset gender dysphoria is gender dysphoria. It's only about half of folks who are presenting into clinical care that have any signs or symptoms in early childhood. And I can't tell you the number of conversations I've had both with parents as well as with adolescents who describe an inability to kind of put to words this sense of differentness that they experienced, that when all of a sudden they meet the first transgender person they've met or they go to the first event, that all of a sudden there's a language and there's a clarity that they can say, ah, this is it. This is what I've been struggling with this whole time. And I actually think it's incredibly apropos that you brought up 1985. And you could imagine at that time, there being a study on rapid onset homosexuality, that the idea of social contagion and sexual orientation was something that was very much in vogue at that time and was used to promote things like reparative therapy that created a lot of harm for the LGBT community, just like, unfortunately, this idea of rapid onset gender dysphoria is often invalidating for folks who truly do have gender dysphoria and truly do need support.
So it's perhaps too complicated a question to answer in this environment, but you think that there is a way to conduct the kind of study that you're talking about, meeting the three criteria? You think it is possible?
I think it's absolutely possible. And I think even with good peer review, this study could have been salvaged. I think the conclusion you can draw from Dr. Littman's study is an understanding of how parents who are skeptical about their child's identity feel about their child's identity. I don't think you can draw conclusions about the developmental trajectory of their kids based upon these kinds of interviews. The problem is that the peer review process broke down. And I am all for contrarian research. It should be quality contrarian research. And the metaphor that I often use when I'm describing the study, it's imagining somebody who is a cancer researcher all of a sudden deciding to publish on veterinary medicine. You need to have an understanding of the work that you're engaged in. You have to understand the community and you have to understand this field in order to truly get the nuance, in order, as Aidan was saying, to be able to ask the right questions, the questions that are going to be ethical, that are going to be thoughtful and well-designed.
Troy writes on the Air Talk page, opposition research is great. We shouldn't shy away from controversial topics. We've foregone the ability to have a discussion. As someone who is trans and non-binary, I'm interested in understanding better who I am. Shutting this research down just makes it even less likely that there'll be time and resources devoted to study the transgender experience. We're already dealing with too much anecdotal information that is seldom accurate. That's Troy writing on the Air Talk page. Samantha writes, so you think the study was bad? Do another study. Do it better and publish it. Don't suppress the study. We're at Air Talk talking about the Brown University study with three guests, Jillian K. Melcher of the Wall Street Journal, Aidan Olson Kennedy of the LA Gender Center, and Dr. Aaron Jansen of NYU's Child Study Center. You can share your comments on the Air Talk page, kpcc.org, and let us know your thoughts. Lisa in Altadena says, I absolutely support the idea that people are born gay or that there is gender dysphoria, but my observation as a parent of teenagers is that so often young people are in a rush to define themselves at a young age because they see their peers doing it. You can share your comments again on the Air Talk page, kpcc.org. Our thanks to our guests joining us in conversation. Stay tuned. Fresh Air with Terry Gross comes up next. Have a terrific afternoon.